You know, when you think about how a massive federal agency operates, you usually picture like a room full of endless dashboards.
Right, like a command center.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Meticulous data tracking, every single outcome being measured, cross-referenced, logged. It's almost like a giant heartbeat monitor keeping an eye on the health of the whole system, just making sure nothing slips through the cracks.
And well, data really is the bedrock of federal oversight. I mean, without those metrics, you basically have no baseline to determine if a multi-billion dollar system is functioning or failing or, actively causing harm. The assumption is always that the government wants more visibility, not less.
But what happens when someone at the top decides to just, I don't know, reach over and unplug the monitor? Like when the data suddenly goes dark, but the reality on the ground, the actual human beings moving through the system, just keeps going.
That takes you into some incredibly murky territory. Because when official reporting stops, the real-world consequences don't just vanish. The systemic failures, the financial transfers, the human toll, they just happen in the shadows, entirely insulated from any kind of public scrutiny.
And that brings us to today. Welcome to today's deep dive. We are unpacking a massive stack of recent journalistic investigations, federal court documents, and independent reports, all concerning U.S. immigration and customs enforcement.
Is a massive paper trail.
It really is. We are looking at a sweeping set of documents detailing the agency's accountability, surging death rates, medical neglect, the booming influence of private prison contractors, and a highly organized crackdown on public dissent.
Which is a lot to cover.
It's a ton. And look, we know just saying the word ICE immediately raises political temperature.
Absolutely.
But today, we aren't interested in partisan talking points. We are looking at reports involving the Trump administration, the Department of Justice, and lawmakers across the whole political spectrum. Our mission here is strictly to follow the data, the court documents, and the investigative journalism to see what is actually happening.
Right, we aren't taking a political side here. We just want to impartially report on the content provided and help you, the listener, understand the sheer scope of this shift in federal enforcement.
Exactly.
Because this really is a fundamental shift. Whether you track civil liberties or federal spending or just government accountability, the paper trail we are looking at today connects dots that might otherwise seem, well, completely unrelated.
Like what?
Well, like a local health crisis in Texas. An internet parody site in Los Angeles, an obscure administrative rule change in Washington. These aren't just isolated incidents. They actually map out a highly coordinated transformation in how federal power is being deployed and, crucially, shielded.
So let's start where the stakes are the absolute highest, which is the direct human cost of these detention policies. A recent massive Reuters analysis dug into the numbers and found that the death rate in ICE detention has more than doubled under Trump's second term.
Doubled.
Doubled. They verified 50 deaths just since January 2025. 50 people.
Yeah, and to see a mortality rate double in a federally regulated environment over such a short window is, I mean, it's a glaring systemic alarm.
It has to be.
Right. And when you cross-reference the Reuters data with investigations from the Associated Press and independent watchdogs, a very specific pattern emerges.
It's not just bad luck.
No, not at all. These aren't just random, unavoidable illnesses. The documentation points to severe, repeated medical neglect. We're talking about ignored emergency calls, a chronic lack of mental health care, and just a completely unprecedented surge in suicides among people held in custody.
The details of these specific cases, when you read through them, they are just haunting. Like you have Royer Perez Jimenez, a 19-year-old Mexican migrant who died in a Florida county jail that already had a documented extensive history of abuse allegations.
Right, a known facility.
And then there are the people who survived the detention itself, but the physical toll is devastating. Rodney Taylor, for instance, a double amputee, he recently got out and has been speaking publicly about the sheer impossibility of surviving in those facilities with a severe disability.
He described an environment where basic medical needs are just structurally ignored.
Exactly. And that structural neglect, it frequently extends beyond the actual walls of the detention centers, too.
Oh, absolutely. Take the case of Daphne Michelle. She was a highly vulnerable Haitian woman in ISC custody. She was released, but the manner of her release was so haphazard and devoid of a basic care transition that she was found dead of hypothermia at a bus shelter in Pittsburgh shortly after. And get this, the local medical examiner actually ruled her death a homicide.
Wait, homicide? How does a medical examiner justify a homicide ruling for someone freezing at a bus stop? I mean, was she attacked?
No, so in a medical legal context, A homicide ruling doesn't necessarily mean someone actively attacked her. It means her death was the direct result of the actions, or in this case, the gross negligence of another entity.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. By discharging a medically fragile person into freezing conditions with zero transition plan or resources, the agency effectively set a fatal chain of events into motion.
That is just a profound indictment of their release protocols.
It really is. And you see similar structural breakdowns with infectious diseases, too. There was a reported measles outbreak at an ICE tent camp in El Paso, which, you know, only happens when basic immunization and quarantine protocols completely fail.
Right. Measles is super preventable.
Exactly. And at the Dilley Family Detention Center in Texas, families have actually smuggled out letters detailing moldy food and non-existent hygiene standards.
Which brings us directly back to that unplugged heartbeat monitor analogy, because right as these death rates are surging and right as these horrific medical outcomes are peaking, a report from The Guardian revealed a new internal directive.
Yeah, the secrecy memo.
Right. ICE's acting director reportedly ordered the agency to stop reporting the deaths of detainees who die shortly after being released.
Changing the parameters of what you legally have to count. It's the oldest bureaucratic trick in the book.
It's like a hospital discharging a crashing critical patient to the sidewalk just so the person doesn't technically die in a hospital bed. You know, just completely artificially keeping their official mortality stats down. How can a federal agency legally justify hiding that kind of mortality data from the public?
Well, administratively, they argue it's a jurisdictional boundary. They claim that the second someone is no longer in their direct physical custody, that individual is no longer their legal responsibility to track.
How convenient.
Right. But practically speaking, if you systematically release critically ill individuals days or even hours before they succumb to conditions they developed or exacerbated while inside, you are heavily obscuring the true lethality of your facilities.
Yeah, you're hiding the human toll.
Exactly. When you sever the data collection, you sever the accountability. You force independent watchdogs and local medical examiners to try and piece together the true human cost after the fact.
So if the outcomes are this consistently catastrophic, why is the system operating this way? Like, who benefits from this specific structure?
Well, you have to follow the money here.
Right, because the federal government doesn't actually run all of these detention centers themselves, do they?
Far from it. A massive foundational portion of the immigration detention infrastructure is outsourced to private prison contractors.
Mm.
We're talking about companies like the GEO Group, who hold billions of dollars in federal contracts to build, staff, and maintain these facilities.
Billions.
Yes. And recently, according to the Associated Press, ICE quietly revised its national detention standards. And critics who have analyzed these revisions argue they are explicitly designed to benefit the profit margins of these private contractors, specifically by gutting overhead costs and weakening oversight.
Yeah, I was looking at the breakdown of those revised standards, and the cost-cutting measures are wild. They are actively replacing human guards and communication monitors with AI assistants.
AI monitors.
And they are maintaining the voluntary work program, which is basically a loophole that allows private contractors to pay detainees just $1 a day for their labor to cook, clean, and run the facility.
$1.
And on top of that, the new standards reportedly raise the threshold for seriously ill detainees to even qualify for specialized outside medical care.
Let's actually look at the mechanics of that $1 a day labor program for a second, because it is crucial to the business model.
Okay.
This is civil detention, not criminal. Now, in the criminal justice system, the 13th Amendment has a loophole allowing for penal labor.
Right.
Prison labor. Exactly. But in civil immigration detention, these individuals are legally not being punished for a crime. They are just being held pending an administrative hearing.
So they shouldn't be subjected to penal labor?
No, they shouldn't. Yet, the private contractors rely entirely on this captive workforce. If a private prison company actually had to pay minimum wage to the hundreds of people doing the laundry, cooking the food, and scrubbing the floors, their profit margins would completely evaporate.
That's incredible. And the ties between these private corporations and the federal regulators setting these rules are just, well, they're hiding in plain sight.
Very much so.
The Trump administration appointed David Venturella to lead ICE. Before taking the job, Venturella was literally an executive at the GEO Group.
Yeah, a former executive.
The guy who helped run one of the largest private prison companies in the world was suddenly in charge of the federal agency that issues their contracts.
The revolving door between the regulated industry and the regulator is just spinning at lightning speed. But the financial influence doesn't stop at the executive branch. It flows heavily into the legislative branch, too.
Of course it does.
Investigations have tracked immense amounts of political spending. The Guardian highlighted financial ties involving Representative Jim Jordan's political network, which reportedly received significant dark money contributions from a super PAC inextricably linked to the GEO group.
Okay, we hear the term dark money all the time, but what does that actually mean in this specific context? Like, how does a private prison company fund a lawmaker without breaking the law?
Good question. So, dark money refers to political spending by nonprofit organizations that are not legally required to disclose their donors.
The disclosure loophole.
Right. So a corporate entity, like a private prison contractor, can funnel millions of dollars into a 501c4 nonprofit or a specific type of super PAC. That PAC then spends millions running ads and supporting a specific lawmaker like someone chairing a judiciary or oversight committee.
Wow.
The money is legally permissible, but the paper trail shielding the donor's identity means a corporation can exert massive financial leverage over the exact lawmakers dictating their oversight, and the public never sees the receipts.
Which perfectly sets up the most mind-bending paradox in this entire stack of sources. Representative LaMonica McIver has been pointing out that the profit motives of these private contractors are fundamentally undermining the federal government's own stated policy.
Yes, the policy clash.
Right. The administration says the goal is rapid mass deportation. But immigrants are reportedly being held in these private IC jails for months after they have legally agreed to voluntary departure.
They're just stuck there.
Yeah. They've signed the papers, they're ready to leave the U.S., and they are just sitting in a cell.
It sounds totally contradictory until you look at how the contracts are structured. Many of these federal contracts include what are called guaranteed bed minimums.
What does that mean?
It means the government agrees to pay the private contractor for a certain number of beds every single night, regardless of whether they are full or empty. And they pay a per diem rate for every person held.
Okay, so it's like a hotel that gets paid by the government per occupied bed. The hotel management has absolutely zero financial incentive to ever check anyone out. If anything, they want the lobby bottlenecked so nobody leaves. Because if the stated federal goal is rapid deportation, this profit model is actively working against it.
Exactly. The system isn't broken. It is functioning exactly as its financial incentives dictate. When private entities profit from the duration of detention rather than the resolution of the immigration case, systemic bottlenecks become highly lucrative business models. Keeping a compliant person who has already agreed to leave in a bed for an extra 90 days generates pure revenue.
So detention is no longer just a mechanism to facilitate deportation?
No. Detention has become the product itself.
Jeez. So if the federal government is locked into these profit-driven contracts that incentivize keeping beds full while simultaneously slashing medical care and food budgets, how long before the pressure inside those beds simply boils over?
Well, it already is. Moving from the corporate boardrooms back down to the ground level, the people trapped inside these privatized facilities are actively organizing.
They're fighting back.
Yeah. The sources document a massive coordinated wave of hunger strikes and labor strikes across the country.
The standoff at Delaney Hall in New Jersey is a perfect example of this. Nearly 40 women and eventually about 300 total detainees went on strike.
A massive strike.
And they weren't just protesting the spoiled food or the physical abuse, which was bad enough. They were striking over severe environmental toxicity. Delaney Hall is literally built in an area of Newark known as the Chemical Corridor.
Right, the location itself is hazardous.
Yeah, they were protesting constant sewage odors and highly toxic industrial runoff surrounding the facility.
And the response from the authorities to this internal organizing was incredibly violent. Rather than addressing the environmental or health complaints, reports indicate that ICE agents deployed batons, pepper spray, and stun guns to break the strike and force compliance.
The coercion tactics go beyond physical force, too. I mean, look at the facility in Florida that got nicknamed Alligator Alcatraz.
Oh, that case.
The conditions were so horrific that ICE eventually had to announce they were relocating the detainees. But before that happened, detainees alleged that guards purposefully gave them contaminated water and actively denied them any meals until they signed specific legal documents.
Which is horrifying.
And the darkest part. The documents were written entirely in English, a language these specific detainees did not read or understand.
This brings up a critical legal distinction that really often gets lost in the public debate. You are looking at a profound abuse of the civil detention framework.
I just don't understand the legality of that. Like, if an armed guard hands you a contract in a language you can't read and tells you that you will not get clean water or food until you sign it, how is that a legally binding document? Isn't that just a hostage situation dressed up as administrative paperwork?
Well, the criminal justice system, you have strict rules regarding coercion, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have the right to a public defender and rigorous judicial safeguards against forced confessions.
Right, Miranda rights and all that.
Exactly.
Hmm.
But civil immigration detention lacks almost all of those safeguards. You do not have a constitutional right to a free lawyer in immigration court. Because the system classifies this as administrative compliance rather than criminal punishment, vulnerable populations are highly susceptible to extreme coercion.
Just to sign away their rights.
Yeah, to waive their hearings or agree to specific conditions. The authorities get the signature they need to process the file, and the context of how they extracted that signature is completely buried.
So that is the pressure cooking inside the walls. But what happens when that pressure leaks out into the public eye? Because the federal response to outside dissent, like activists, local officials, even regular citizens, is escalating just as dramatically.
We are seeing a distinct pivot here.
Yeah.
The agency is expanding its target list from undocumented individuals to U.S. citizens, local organizers, and even the judicial system itself.
The retaliation is intense. The Real News reported that 15 people, including trade unionists in Minnesota, were hit with federal indictments, specifically for acting as ICE observers and organizing immigrant rights protests.
Right. And in Wisconsin, a federal judge upheld the criminal conviction of Hannah Dugan, who is a former judge herself, simply for helping a man evade federal agents. In Portland, an anti-ICE protester was slapped with a 30-month federal prison sentence.
And they are utilizing advanced surveillance and national security tools to cast an incredibly wide net, catching people who aren't even traditional activists.
Yes, this is the part of the investigation that truly stunned me. The Department of Homeland Security issued a be on the lookout alert, a BLO for a comedian named Ben Palmer.
A federal alert for a comedian.
His crime. He created a parody ICE tip website. It was a joke. I mean, issuing a federal national security level BLO alert for an internet prank isn't just an overreaction. It's like
yeah.
It's like using a military drone to swat a mosquito.
It really is.
What does it say about an agency's culture when an internet prank triggers that kind of response? Are they repurposing federal counterterrorism tools for corporate reputation management? It reveals a deeply entrenched bunker mentality. When a federal agency views local protesters, local police who limit cooperation, and comedians as active operational threats, they stop acting like a standard law enforcement body.
What do they become?
They begin operating as a sprawling defensive surveillance apparatus focused on silencing dissent through intimidation.
And that defensive militant posture is being pushed from the highest levels of the White House. The documents show that internal alarms were ringing after proposals by figures like J.D. Vance and Stephen Miller to invoke the Insurrection Act and suspend habeas corpus specifically to crush anti-ICP protests.
Let's pause on that, because suspending habeas corpus is the nuclear option of federal power.
Explain that for those who might not know.
Habeas corpus is the fundamental, bedrock constitutional right that allows you to demand a judge verify if the government is holding you legally. If you suspend it, the government can detain anyone indefinitely without ever having to prove to a court that a crime was committed.
And proposing that against domestic protesters.
It's staggering.
The aggression is already spilling into the streets, too. We have a report that U.S. Senator Andy Kim was actually pepper sprayed by federal agents while he was simply trying to de-escalate a protest outside a New Jersey facility.
A sitting senator.
Yeah. It's no wonder lawmakers like Representative Jamie Raskin are publicly characterizing ICE as a secret paramilitary force.
Well, when you look at their operational tactics, Raskin's description aligns with the data. The investigations detail ICE agents increasingly operating in masks to obscure their identities, which critics point out makes it terrifyingly easy for criminals to impersonate agents.
Oh, wow.
Furthermore, there is an internal memo authorizing officers to conduct home entries using only administrative warrants.
Wait, explain the difference there, because a warrant is a warrant, right? Why does it matter if it's an administrative warrant?
It matters immensely. A judicial warrant is signed by an impartial third-party judge who has reviewed hard evidence and determined there's probable cause of a crime. It is a foundational check and balance. An administrative warrant is essentially an internal permission slip. It is signed by another ICE officer for a civil immigration violation.
Just another officer.
Just another officer. Using an internal agency slip to bypass a judge and kick down a residential door is a massive blurring of constitutional boundaries. They're utilizing body camera footage combined with facial recognition technology to conduct violent raids like the one documented against farm workers in Oregon.
And the secrecy isn't just happening on the streets. They are actively fighting transparency in the courtroom. Reason magazine highlighted a case where ICE submitted documents to a federal judge, but completely redacted the agency's reasoning for why they were detaining the individual in the first place.
They blacked out their own rationale.
Yeah. And the judge was furious. He literally called ICE's practice of hiding its rationale from the court repugnant to the rule of law.
And when states try to pull back from this apparatus, the federal government attacks them legally. The Department of Justice is actively suing states like Maine, Massachusetts, Oregon, Washington, because those states are refusing to issue undercover confidential license plates to ICE vehicles.
Ghost plates.
Right. The states argue that providing ghost plates conceals operations from the community and harms public safety.
Yeah.
The DOJ argues the states are illegally interfering with federal enforcement.
Man, when you pull all these threads together, the picture that emerges is just overwhelming. I mean, we started with the sheer human toll, the doubling of death rates, the unchecked suicides, and the bureaucratic sleight of hand to stop tracking mortality data.
The secrecy memo.
Right. And then we unpack the financial engine driving this, where private contractors like the GEO Group use dark money and $1 a day labor to turn prolonged human detention into a highly lucrative product.
Duration over resolution.
Exactly. We saw how those exact financial incentives create the toxic, abusive conditions that spark hunger strikes. And we watched how the agency uses everything from stun guns to national security alerts to crush both internal resistance and external public dissent.
It really is a comprehensive restructuring of accountability.
To really ground this in the scale of what we are talking about, I want to highlight one specific statistic from the Brookings Institution that was corroborated across multiple reports in our stack. They estimate that over 145,000 children have been separated from their parents due to ICE detentions just since 2025.
It's a staggering number.
145,000 kids. You could fill massive football stadiums with the families fractured by this specific policy shift.
It is a generational trauma being engineered in real time. And, you know, as we wrap up, I want to leave you with one final structural thought to mull over, building on this tension between local communities and federal power.
Okay, what is it?
Consider the escalating, heavy-handed threats the federal government is now deploying against local jurisdictions that refuse to fully cooperate. According to Reuters, the Department of Homeland Security actually threatened to halt all international flights and freeze cargo processing at Newark Liberty International Airport.
Wow.
Yeah, they used the global supply chain as leverage in a dispute with New Jersey over local sanctuary city policies.
So they threatened to financially strangle an international airport just to force local police to do their bidding.
Exactly. And if federal agencies are willing to use international travel, disrupt the broader economy, and bypass judges to force local compliance, it raises a massive looming question. Where does the line between sweeping federal authority and local state sovereignty actually sit in this new era of enforcement? Like, who is actually in control of your community?
That is a question that affects every single person listening, no matter what state you live in.
Thank you for joining us on this incredibly dense deep dive. We threw a lot of heavy, complex information at you today, from administrative warrants to super PACs, but you stuck with it. There's a lot to process.
There is. So keep asking those hard questions, keep looking for the mechanisms behind the headlines, and above all, stay curious. Because as we saw today, just because an agency unplugs the heartbeat monitor doesn't mean the reality on the ground stops. We just have to look a little harder into the shadows.
Absolutely. Keep digging into the sources, because there's always more to this story.